Hello and welcome to the final episode of Series 1 of the Spring Podcast. It's been a pretty quick journey here when you think about it. We started this series of the podcast back in March when lockdown was just kicking off. And just want to say thanks to everyone for tuning in the last while. It's been class. We've really, really enjoyed doing it. We can't believe how well it's gone and, you know, how much I suppose people have enjoyed it and that we got to speak to, you know, lots of people that were involved at the time. It's just been a fantastic experience. And look, thanks to everyone that's tuned in and given us feedback and got in touch with comments and whatever. It's all been fantastic. And we're so happy that, you know, we could give you the, you know, a bit of escapism, I suppose, for a couple of hours every week to relive one of the best seasons in the sports history. So, we're just going to, for this episode, we're just going to have a quick look back at the whole season and our thoughts. And if now, after all, you know, the research we've done in the last while and stuff like that. So, Tommy and William are back with us once again this week.
Hello, back by unpopular demand.
Yeah, I mean, I have to finish it off with turning up.
Come on, yeah.
It would have been more fitting if I just didn't turn up tonight.
Looking back in it, I have to say, like, that, you know, we always held to those in the one in high regard. And to be honest, you know, I didn't, at the start of this series, you know, we kind of outlined we'd do an episode per round, and it kind of developed from there. We ended up getting some great guests on as well, and that gave us, you know, even more insight into what was happening at the time. But I think, far from becoming kind of sick of looking back, it's actually reinforce that belief, and I really do think it was one of the best years ever. Would you agree with that, or would you disagree?
I'd have to fully agree. If anything, it's reinforced it, and I think looking back at it, and even with an even more critical eye than we probably had at the time, you know, we're fairly critical people, and annoyingly so, some people might find.
Yeah, but I'm very cynical as an author.
But like, when you look back at it, there, it had so many layers. When you strip it back, you know, and look at it now in the detail that we have done, that, you know, I suppose that the passing of time has been a great help. That, and obviously, you know, with the every year passing, more stories emerge and a bit more detail comes. And obviously, as we become more familiar with the sport ourselves, between being spectators or competitors or whatever, gives you a better imagination or something of it. But at the same time, the one thing remains. You can still see why it had such an impact. And it was a pleasure to go back over it. And to be honest with you, I found myself rewatching some of the ones that we covered earlier on in the series of podcasts, watching some of the reviews again of them on the TV. Just
that's the point I was going to make as well, Tommy, about Morris mentioned as well, about kind of reaffirming.
I stole your notes, though, they say, so.
Yeah. That's all Tommy does he steal his notes.
The Tom notes and drive the wrong way up stages.
Yeah, Tommy doesn't write his own pace notes. He just steals them,
yeah.
But no, but like, on that point of kind of going back and trying to reaffirm why it was such a good year, like Tommy said there, I found myself going back into the rabbit holes of archives and pulling out all the DVDs I didn't pull up, my old stack of WRC DVDs from that era as well, and start watching them again over the weekend. And it's just, yeah, it's nice to revisit again. It kind of brings back that element of that innocence of childhood where nothing else mattered except rally.
The danger of nostalgia is that, you know, we're stuck in 2001 now, send help. But the danger of nostalgia is also that you look at it with rose-tinted glasses and you think, oh, yeah, that was way better, you know, and you completely ignore, you know, what's around you right now. Obviously, there's not much around us right now, but really, there was no rose-tinted glasses about this, because, to be fair, it stood the test of time this season. When you look back at it, you know, the cars still look awesome today. Like, I think, Morris, you listed off the drivers' standings points at the end of the season, and it was just a roll call of, you know, yeah, he was a hero, yeah, he was a hero, yeah, and that was even going outside the top 10 of who finished in the top 10 of the World Championship points, just, it's reinforced it, really.
Yeah, I think, Tommy, like I don't kind of flirt with the line of saying we're looking back at our rose-tinted glasses. I think, and especially with doing this season, I think we've done it very objectively, and we've painted out rally by rally why it was such a good year. Not just the case of, like, come by Austin, the old teams are better, and ignoring what's in front of you. Like, we have an incredible combination at the minute in the World Championship of probably the last of the best cars we've seen for a long time. The competition, the pace is unbelievable. There's some incredibly capable drivers, and there's a good talent pool coming up behind them, but it just doesn't have the same level of awe. And it's not even because we saw it at a young age, but I just said, if you rattle off the teams, the drivers, the stories, I mean, like, we've seen them throughout the season, you just don't get the same effect.
I think, though, there's an element too, though, of you can learn a lot. It's almost like you need to nearly look backwards to go forwards with some of these things. And nowadays we kind of have mass coverage, you know, it's kind of saturated with things like apps, WRC+, and they're fantastic innovations. They're unbelievable. But it was something that kind of, it came at me a different angle. I was watching a couple of documentaries about cycling, about Marco Pantani, the Italian cyclist, and one about Lance Armstrong. The places you'd see cycling and the places you'd see rallying were generally the same places. You'd see it on places like Eurosport, or you'd see it on, you know, BBC. And because of that, there was almost an exotic nature to it, you know? And
I think... one was far more cheating. I'll let you decide.
Yeah, which one had more cheating? But it's funny, though, that even off the back of, you know, comparing this... we had the discussion about R5 becoming the top category, and you could see the parallels and how it would make sense for, you know, present day rallying at the top tier to adopt an R5 based formula simply off of how good the level of competition and talent pool they were able to employ back in 2001 being an example of it.
Yeah.
You know, it could be replicated to a degree, you know.
With seven different manufacturers, most of whom were sending three cars to nearly every rally, sometimes four, and we had eight different winners throughout a 14-round season. Like, that's almost unimaginable these days in any top-level motorsport to have, you know, and to have four guys going into the final round with a shot at the title. You know, we went through all the rounds at this stage, and not, you know, we've discovered that each round was really important in its own way to the overall picture. Something exciting happened in every round, whether it be, you know, a championship contender falling by the wayside, someone getting their first win. I think if you look at it, Rovan Perra's first win and only win, Purus's first win and only win in 2001 alone. Am I forgetting more?
Purus, yeah.
You know, they were just two of the guys. You'd the kind of emergence of Sebastian Loeb as a threat. You had kind of the changing of the guard when it came to, you know, the old style of driving with the likes of McRae and McInnes' approach compared to the Burns and subsequent approach that was about to start taking over. There was just so much, and like, yeah, I think as well. We're so lucky to get the guests on and that we did, and that we're able to give us the insights into it. It just reaffirmed basically what we'd taught already. And I'm like you, Tommy, I've actually found myself going back and watching episodes again, even though we've covered, you know, we've watched them already for research. We've consumed as much meat as we can. We've recorded the podcast, released it. Probably, you know, but I'm not getting sick of it. It's really strange. It's a great sign of the year that it just shows how good it really was and how good everything around it was, the TV coverage and everything.
And Morris, as you said there, like, it's maybe it's just that whatever algorithms are working online on the different social media platforms, but you're finding bits and snippets coming up on different pages with photographs from people who are at events, different video clips from different stages. I'm starting to see more pop up in the last couple of months, and it's just, like I said, you can never get sick of it.
Yeah, no, totally agree. But anyway, We're just going to give just a quick look. No, we're not going to cover too much ground because we will be covering stuff in future episodes of the podcast around subsequent years and things like that.
Have we not covered enough so far in the season? I don't know. I reckon an hour again on each episode would be more than enough.
Do you think?
For each round. I think the people are crying out for this now.
No,
you know, their ears have not suffered enough abuse.
No, I think they have enough, but no. Yeah, I'll take a backseat for that one. I think I'll let you run away with that one if you want. But I suppose if we just go through maybe team by team, and we can see where things kind of ended up. I suppose we'll start with Subaru, just looking at where the team itself and the crews ended up in the years following. Obviously, Burns champion, so. In 2001, made the much publicised move to Peugeot in 2002. Unfortunately, didn't have a fantastic year in 2002 up against Granholm. Was well in contention for the title in 2003 until the very tragic events before GB, where he was diagnosed with a brain tumour and unfortunately passed away in 2005. So, very kind of a sad end for him. With, you know, we spoke about that with Robert Reed last week's episode. But he had an awful lot left to give. He was due to go to Subaru in 2004. And, you know, it would have been very, very interesting to see how that panned out. But unfortunately, didn't work out for him.
To be fair to him, in the following 2 years at Peugeot, like Finland, he could have won that rally. And in New Zealand, he was leading the rally when, unfortunately, he had the quite sizable accident while leading Granholm. Like he had the winning of the championship, which was in his first year at Peugeot, which was even more impressive when, I suppose, when you look at what Robert alluded to in the last episode about the plan was you'd do 1 year and then the next year you'd go and attack. Fantastic approach to doing it. Even, you know, when you're in a new team, new surroundings, it's arguably a much different culture, you know, the French culture as opposed to the UK-based culture of Subaru.
Yeah, yeah. Then looking at his teammate for the year, Petter Solbrook, who actually did win the 2003 title. It's turned out to be his only title, but Petter was one of the frontline contenders throughout the 2000s. He stuck with Subaru for the majority of his career until Subaru themselves actually pulled out at the end of 2008 due to the kind of worldwide economic downturn at the time. And for the last couple of years, he was having a bit of a nightmare of a time. Just the car wasn't at the races at all compared to where Subaru were. It was kind of sad to watch, really.
Yeah, just on that point, Marcus, you were talking about the time when they pulled out in 2008. I think for me, I know we're jumping a bit ahead, but for me, that was one of those moments of remembering where I was. So bad. I remember driving home. I think I was coming home from Limerick back to Tip, and driving, and my brother rang me, telling me about it.
Yeah.
And again, to some people, it's actually. But I remember at the time going, "Oh my god,
that was huge." Subaru, to us, like Subaru were rallying. Do you know, to an awful lot of people, because and that's all kind of leading back to the McRae era. You know, with kicking off at the legacy and then into his title winning year '95 with the famous blue and yellow 555 colours. I mean, that's, you know, to anyone on the street, Subaru was a rally car, whereas if you went back, you know, into the 80s, a Subaru was a farmer's car. You know, it was such a huge turnaround in their reputation. It was kind of sad to see them kind of dwindle away.
They were the Ferrari, really, of rallying in terms of, as a brand, you know, they were so synonymous with rallying, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
To Morris's point there, when you see the difference of where they came from, where they were never a performance car brand, they weren't a normal car brand, they were, as you said, a farmer's vehicle, a rough and ready kind of mechanical agriculture look, and then all of a sudden they put effort behind a motorsport program and look what it did to them.
Yeah, I remember
there was a VHS tape that I got, I think I was 15 or 16, it was the story of the Subaru Impreza, but there was an interview with David Lapworth in it, and he said that basically on the same lines as what you're saying of being a farmer's car, the turnaround had been so much that it was a premium performance car. Now, you had to get on a waiting list to get the top of the range in Impreza or Legacies in the UK at the time.
Yeah.
The brand repositioning through, you know, possibly the coolest sport in our view.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that they really did capitalize on it, and it's something that no manufacturer has really done since to the same extent. Mitsubishi had something similar going on. But again, this ties back into, you know, the cars having to be homologated back in the 90s for Group A and things like that, which is something we'll touch on in future episodes. But yeah, look, just kind of a sad end. The other guys that appeared for Subaru throughout the year, Macker Martin, who moved to Ford in 2002, started showing some great promise. 2003 and 2004, he really, really locked into that fantastic Christian Lorio design focus. We'll be doing a couple of episodes on 2003 in the next season, so we'll keep our powder dry for those. But then moved to Peugeot for 2005, and unfortunately another tragic accident in GB in 2005, where his co-driver Michael Park, or Beef as he was affectionately known, was unfortunately killed. And that was Marco then ended up retiring from frontline competition. So kind of a sad end, and a guy that a crew that had great promise that unfortunately went, you know, ultimately unfulfilled. But
and you're saying there, Marcel, with Marco Martin's kind of rise up even before he went to Ford, like it's a shame where you see, if you look through the 2001 season in particular, where, like, obviously he was kind of down in 19th or 20th in the overall championship that year, but his flashes of performance at the really important times really set him up to show what he could do. You don't see a lot of that now. You know, think of it back then, you were guys who could, they could have, they're very, very start of their career, they're very young, and one or two very good drives, good stage times at the right points, and they were getting opportunities. Whereas now, if you're two rallies and you crash the next one, you're forgotten about.
Yeah. I think a lot of that, though, is it's unfortunately a symptom of the fact that the cars have grown exponentially in the price, and also the amount of teams participating have reduced.
Plus the fact that people do things a lot faster now and people don't have much patience.
Yeah, the expectation is far higher for far sooner.
Yeah,
and Robert Reed actually mentioned the last episode, you know, that people are going into these, you know, frontline cars a bit too quickly, and not you know, you know, they mightn't be allowed to even have the time to build their speed up in the lower formula. So that's probably a contributing factor to it as well.
There was a great point that he made in that when he was talking about the likes of Robbie Head and Colin, and obviously Richard went into the 205 challenge, that there were class cars. Like nowadays, you know, you're sold this notion that to be part of the ladder opportunity, yeah, here it is, this is step one here, it's a 40 grand Fiesta. That's not feasible for 90% of the population, even in rallying terms, you know, because it's
absolutely, yeah, no, it's gone beyond the reach. But look, that's, we won't get too bogged down in that right now, because we'll end up depressing everyone for the final episode of the series.
I'm furious here now, just even.
Yeah. I'm fraught at the moment. And then Tashi Aradin just kind of plugged away with Subaru, appeared in various, I don't know, did he do much more on the World Car? I think he did Japan, rallied Japan a couple of times whenever it was a world round in the mid-2000s, and was kind of tearing away and grouping cars there for a long time. But
that's another great good rally hunt for them, because you come across some really cool footage from over in Japan with like different promo days and different events where Tashi Aradin after driving there. There's some cool stuff. If you go searching long enough, you'll find it.
Yeah, good point actually. Yeah, there's a good few of those knocking around. So that was Subaru. We'll look at where we go, Hyundai next for the crack. So who do we have in Hyundai? We had Kenneth Eriksson.
Yeah.
Kenneth went to Skoda for 2002. Kind of tore away. That was pretty much the end of things. Not much happened after that.
He wasn't even there in 2001 either, was he?
Nah, look, to be fair, you know, Hyundai themselves as a team weren't, you know, they were realistic too. They knew that they didn't have the ultimate pace of Well,
he was 16 GB.
Yeah, he was.
I don't think it's any reflection on Ericsson's ability. No. He was a fantastic driver. I just think that the Hyundai was never going to be in the right place for road position and things like that. Just circumstances, you know. It's,
yeah. No, that was kind of yeah, he was at the tail end of his career. He'd been around for a long time. He looked fresh faced enough, but he was actually, I think, well into his 40s even at this stage. So still a very good driver, but you know, he was kind of pretty much just making up the numbers at this point. Alistair McRae then, in the other car, he ended up moving to Mitsubishi for 2002. So I think it was Jack Martyr on Twitter dug it out there for us during the week. He found an old Rally XS where Alistair was doing some pre-season testing in the 2002 Lancer, and came up with the statement that, "I think on pace alone, we have a good chance at winning a rally this year," which was to not age well.
A rally. Not a rally.
Incorrect.
They might have misspelled start as win, maybe. I don't know. But that didn't prove to be...
those guys doing PR for those teams who come out, let's just call it lies, right? I mean, what
it's
a way
on lies, yeah. It's just lies.
What a way to make a living, just making up lies and going, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
To be fair to Alistair, though, I think we talked about Richard Burns living in the shadow of Colin McRae. He obviously was living in the shadow of the two of them because, you know, he was a very, very capable driver. Won the BRC against people like Harry Rovanpera, Gwyn Duff Evans, and all these guys. And, you know, I think in following years, like, there was rule changes in the World Rally Championship where the teams that were running three cars, I think was it 2004, Mars, that they were obliged to only run two cars.
I think so, yeah.
And everything's off the window.
Yeah, and the co-driver's name's off the window, yeah. But that did such damage to the talent pool that was there, it whittled it down very quickly that, you know, the drives just simply weren't there for the guys that were out there, and a lot of them ended up back in doing PWRC and things like that. They'd never get a chance to get back into the top line again, you know?
Yeah, Alistair ended up competing in the PWRC against Vince Nye next year, actually in 2004, didn't they?
Yeah.
The year that Nye won that title. So, just a kind of an interesting one to note. Who else was it? I wonder. Piero Leatti, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Piero, I don't know, did he do a couple of events from 2002? I'm not sure. He was another guy like kind of like Ericsson. He'd been around for a bit at that stage and was kind of getting the odd drive at Hyundai here and there, but I don't think he did anything of great note after that.
He was the first man to win a rally in a World Rally car, though.
He was, in fairness to him, 1997 in the Tudor Subaru. So, very good driver, really, really good tarmac driver. So, why they were putting him in for rallies like GB, no one knows. But anyway,
he was also of the school that he was going to be one of those smooth lined drivers of the future, wasn't he?
Yeah. I don't know. But anyway, Hyundai themselves then ended up not even actually completing the 2003 season. They did 2002 with Freddie Likes, and Juha was in there for a bit, and Armin Schwartz, and ran into financial trouble in 2003. There was a bit of an acrimonious split between MSD, who were running the car, and Hyundai themselves, and we didn't see another Hyundai World Rally car until 2013 or 14, whenever the i20 came out. Yeah, so that was the end of it. They never really got any great results anyway in the subsequent years as well. But still, look, they gave it a crack. They tried their best. Made the Accent, which was one of the worst road cars you'll ever have the misfortune to drive. Believe me.
My father has one.
Oh, man. That's so bad. Sorry, Tommy, but like, tell your father. Just go.
I've driven it. It's cat.
Cat. But anyway,
another WRC inspired car in our yard.
And they had their PR team was absolutely unbelievable as well, as Art mentioned in the Australia episode. They were pulling the blind. Actually, yeah, the probably PR performance of the year definitely goes to Hyundai's team. So Where we go next? We go to Peugeot.
Peugeot, Didier Auriol. We didn't see him again in 2002. He took a sabbatical, or basically just didn't get a drive until 2003, when he returned with Skoda, because obviously they had the Fabia coming on stream, so they thought that it might be a good idea to get him in with his experience, I'd say, from the 206 and that. But
yeah,
he bowed out at the end of the season. He didn't seem to have a great year there either.
No, he didn't have a great year with Skoda. They never really got the Fabia there. We'll get to that in a minute. But he was again another guy. I suppose looking at it now, are we kind of just turning around and making shit of everything we've just said about how great 2001 is when we look at all these guys at the end of their careers? But hello, you know, they were still quick. You know, anyone who could still win at the front line. At that point was still a very quick driver. He'd won in Catalonia and he'd actually put in some great performances towards the end of the year. Maybe he kind of realised his place was under threat, and but there was lots of internal issues with him and Peugeot at that point, so I don't think he was in with any hope of staying on. But surprised actually he got a drive in 2003, but then again that's something we'll cover on a future episode.
But that would be typical of the Skoda recruitment policy, though. They would go for experience.
Yes, it proved to be a bit of an old folks home, to be fair to them. Which is grand too, you know. They have to go somewhere. The other Granholm won the title in 2002. He showed, you know, the signs of it in the latter part of this year. He'd definitely been the quickest guy on loose surfaces. If things had been a little bit different at the start of the year in terms of Peugeot reliability, he definitely would have been in contention for the title. He had the pace earlier, just the car would constantly let him down. But 2002 was, to be honest, a bit of a grand old whitewash. I think he had the title sewn up by New Zealand, it's a, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a bit of a shift from what had happened in 2001. But a great driver. Jeez, Marcus was a cracking driver, and he was at the front of the sport there for all the way through the 2000s. Whenever Peugeot,
I think he had, in fairness, he had a big enough role to play in 2001 anyway, because he was taking points away from the, like his, like you said, the lack of reliability in the first half of the season was their undoing. But like, you know, his pace in the second part of the season, it obviously put pressure on the other guys, because with the point system, as it was, like, you know, 10 for first, 6 for second, and 4 for third, every position counted. But when you've this guy who's got no shot at the title out there robbing the points, you know, that's Granholm probably was a big contributing factor in the title being so tight, because in the second half of the season his improvement in pace.
Yeah, in particular, like you said, with him winning Finland. I mean, had he retired there and gave Burns a win in Finland, it would have been a very different story coming back in. You know, and if you look at, let's say, even looking back over the, like, the results, you've three drivers won three events. Burns won one. But the thing I find most interesting is when you look at the podiums outside of a win, Burns won one rally. He had six podiums. The closest person to him with that many podiums outside of a win was Robin Dara.
Yeah.
Granholm would go on to stay with Peugeot until they actually withdrew from the sport at the end of 2005. That was they switched to the 307cc from 2004-2005. Car was an absolute disaster, putting it, you know, by Peugeot standards. You know, the Peugeot, the PSA group were used to coming into sports and dominating him. So this was not a great showing from them. He moved to Ford in for 06-07 and came quite close, to be fair, to winning the title in both years. Didn't quite work out for him, and ended up retiring at the end of the 07. But great driver and a great guy, and probably the tallest man to ever win a world rally, and definitely the tallest man to ever fit in the Peugeot 206 of any sort. The man is, I'd say, about 9 foot tall. He's an absolute stock. I don't know how they got him into it. But anyway,
he was the only man, in fairness, the WRC 2008, the hatchback Impreza World Car, they entered that in Rally Portugal, I think, in 2009.
That's right.
They ran it on, if I remember rightly, the issue was, I don't know, was it where they, someone will correct me on this now, the works cars originally were on either BOS or XTC dampers, one or the other. But they were able to run the car on Rigers because it wasn't a manufacturer entry at this stage. And he ran Loeb and the guys really close on the opening day. I think he had a couple of fastest times and he just got caught out on day two, a small off. Like with a year out in a car that, to be fair, was a bit unloved, you know, at that level.
Yeah.
You know, he could still turn it on.
That first day was there. Not to take away from the pace, but the stages weren't exactly kind of long, challenging stages of an open day Portugal. Because I remember that the two runs should be super special, didn't they?
The white
S14.
It's the white S14. It was done up in Vodafone colours, I think.
That's right.
Because Vodafone were sponsoring the rally. But there was definitely a good half dozen or more stages done. And he was in the fight, you know, like, which has to be said is impressive. My first trip to a World Rally event was 2010. And Marcus was there, I think, on probably one of his last rallies, in a black 08 spec Focus. It was the last year of the 2 litre cars. And he had a very mixed event, but there's a stage, apparently it's his favourite stage, Sagan in Sweden. And he was nowhere in the results because of mechanical issues, and he was still fastest on the stage, just was able to turn it on, you know.
He came back, but last year he was important in Sweden again.
In the Arrows, correct. Great driver, fairness to him, great guy. Unfortunately, not to win a couple of more titles, but that was that. As we mentioned, Peugeot themselves pulled out at the end of 05, and it's actually scary, you know, as we're going through it now, looking at all the teams that pulled out of the championship subsequently. But anyway, that's kind of
forgotten Harry and Gilles?
Yeah, we're just getting on to there now. Harry stayed with Peugeot for 2002 and 2003. Kind of pair programs again. I don't think he ever got a full season with Peugeot, really. I think he was still with him in 04, was he? He went to Mitsubishi for 05, I think.
But did he not have a full program in 2004?
No, he jumped in for Likes. Likes, I think, ended up having to do a bit of the test, and Likes got the drive for 04, and whatever way it got swapped around, they were sharing that seat, I think.
Was that it? Okay. Good old Freddie. Harry, he showed never won another rally. Just Joe 2001 was definitely his peak. He showed great pace throughout the season, and even some great consistency in what he was doing. And you know, if things had worked out differently and a couple of events, he could have actually been in contention for the title in GB. So, but a great performance by him in 2001. In fairness, really, really good drive considering he'd been kind of toing and froing with various drives over the previous couple of years. But had a couple of good spins in the Lancer in 2005. Another victim, I suppose you could say, of the cull in the sport at the end of that year. Mitsubishi themselves pulled out in 2005 as well. There was actually a bloodbath Skoda and everything went. There was only Ford and Subaru left as full teams for 2006, with Citroen doing kind of a part entry through the Cronus Racing team. Just big drop off in the space of 5 years from 2001. But anyway, Panizzi then stayed.
And people wonder why we stay looking back this far.
I know. The more we look at it now, this is as good as it got, really.
But up to like between 2001 2003, you could argue with the amount of teams and the amount of drivers that were there competing at that level, you know, fighting on an even keel, they were all of that same quality. It was better than Formula One in that period. You're obviously comparing with the Schumacher period as well. Yeah. But even taking Schumacher out of it and the Ferrari domination, it was a better spectacle and competition than
Formula One. It always will be, Tommy. I'll sit down and watch the Audi if one event is on, but there's no comparison as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. You didn't have the likes of Williams dropping a driver in for a couple of races that he was extremely good at, like you know, dominating him like you had with the WRC during this year. So that, you know, like Pinizzi here now, for example, Pinizzi was the, you know, he was untouchable again in 2002 in Corsica and San Remo and Catalunya, and he won three rallies, was hopeless in Germany and on the Monte, which again kind of leads us back to the point that we made earlier in the series around Gilles not being able to cope as well with tricky conditions as other drivers. So, but on dry tarmac, probably point to point, probably the quickest in the world at the time. And he was able to put a good use. I think he won San Remo in 2003 and Catalunya as well. He snatched Catalunya in the last stage. Maybe he didn't win San Remo in 2003. We'll find out. We'll do a couple of 2003 episodes and we'll get to that. But the team is that, yeah, tarmac, Pinizzi, that was kind of it. And then he ended up going to Mitsubishi for 2004 and 2005. No major showings there. I think he got third in the Monte one year. But that was it. And ended up in a Red Bull Skoda, sort of a deal for 2006, but that petered out pretty quickly. So that was him. Didn't really do a huge amount after. I don't think he was pretty old at this stage as well. You know, he was probably, you know, gone beyond the age where teams would have been looking for you know, their main drivers at that point, but still very, very quick guy, and that was him. Where do we go next? Let's go to Ford.
Ford, Carlos Sainz. Obviously stayed on. Carlos Sainz, actually, someone who was in the latter stages of his career in the World Rally Championship, he got a couple more seasons further than I think a lot of people might have even assumed he would have at that stage, because the following year he stayed with Ford and had a fairly similar season to what he had in 2001, to be fair. But he was more or less out of a drive, and I think he was only going to get a park program with Citroën. And but I think the Spanish Citroën importer pulled a few strings, and he joined Colin McRae at the Citroën team for 2003.
Go away. Was it only supposed to be a power program? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think the best that he could hope for, because being the sad man that I am, I started watching some of the 2002 reviews and reading up bits ahead like that, and I was watching it, and the talk at the time was that it was kind of really in the balance what he'd actually have for the following year. Because if you actually remember, Lewis Moya and him parted ways at the end of 2002.
Yeah.
And I think, like, it's very difficult to know what way. I think it was amicable enough, but obviously everyone has to earn a wage, and I think the money just wasn't there, I think, to get them as a pair. I don't know how true that is or not, but
okay.
Mark Marty, I think, joined him in 2003.
Okay.
And
Carlos actually was in contention for the 2003 series, wasn't he, as well? Up until GB as well. So, but like, you know, there's not many people like Carlos in motorsport history to be at the top for that long and be, you know, not only competing in the top level, but actually being, you know, one of the guys to beat for so long. He was
Do you remember when he was brought back in when they wrapped François Duval over the knuckles for his performances?
His misdemeanors, yeah.
But even as you say, even post WRC, you look at the level of effort you put into Dakar.
Yeah.
I mean, how many guys can do that?
Yeah.
Be under no illusion, he still does a lot of testing, I believe, for world teams, and he was a heavy influence in the background in Volkswagen's Polo. He was doing a lot of the testing for them as well.
Yeah, he would have. Yeah.
Granholm was as well, wasn't
it? Yeah, Granholm was doing a bit too. Yeah, but Carlos apparently was doing a lot.
Yeah, he would have been at the start of the 1.6 car, the 2013 car, whenever they came in first. He would have had a lot of work done on that. Brilliant guy, absolute superstar, and again testament to the guy that he was able to stay a competitor for so long, even beyond this year, you know. And as you said, the Dakar, which is its own unique challenge, you know, quite different to what the WRC is. So fair play to them. Colin, as we've kind of discussed at length in the GB episode a couple of weeks ago, he had a pretty lacklustre year in 2002 as well, won a couple of events, but wasn't really at the races compared to where he usually had been, with the Citroën 2003, and wasn't at the same level as Loeb or McRae or Sainz, excuse me. Let's be honest, he just had kind of, I suppose his style was on the way out at that stage. And still, again, look, as you mentioned, on raw talent, on a bit of road, you know, especially loose surface, hard to think of anyone that could beat him, but just that wasn't enough for the sport as the years went on.
I was watching Finland 2003 last night, and basically there's an onboard and there's clips of him in Unimpoja in 2003. He was fastest in Unimpoja, so I think any doubt that McRae had lost any of his speed, you could throw that out the window. The speed was there, the talent was there. I question a little bit of the motivation at that stage. Possibly that could have been on the wane. But a phenomenal talent, and, like, you know, I think even Will, you'd agree that he proved that even to come back in the Skoda, an unfancied car, and he was able to, he almost got a very impressive result out of that car.
Yeah, it's a shame that Joe, and again, I know Nicky Chris talked about it a lot on the podcast with Chris Harris about the detail of that event in Skoda and Australia and how much of a shame that was. But don't forget, as well, he came back in 2006 and did Rally Turkey with Kronos.
Yeah. And they looked for him. I don't think he went looking for them.
Well, to be fair, yeah, when you're Colin McRae, you're not going to go looking for a guy.
No.
I mean, I even found the Citroën deal in 2003 strange because, I mean, you had already seen that, obviously, okay, the focus wasn't at the races, but McRae went back in his career. It was a strange move for Citroën to bring him in for 1 year.
I think if Subaru had been on the table around that stage, it might have been a better fit for him. I think, and there was, it's come up many times since that, I think he was going to do Rally Ireland in 2007 and GB. That's been mentioned a couple of times. I think David Richards mentioned it somewhere one time, and with a view to returning in 2008. But obviously we'll never know. And it's a great shame. It's one of those big what ifs, and, you know.
Could you imagine? I think Ireland would explode if you were Colin McRae doing Rally.
Yeah, the crowds were big enough in 2007 as it was. It would have been. It would have been great to see. He'd been here a couple of times. He'd been here for the Lakes in 2005 in the Escort, and he did Donegal in 2006 in the Metro. And he was absolutely incredible to watch. Both times.
Sorry, I'm just going to hear you said there, but the Lakes in 2005 is one thing I'll never forget. And at the Midpoint Radio on Gertnagan, when he came through there, I mean, that was.
Yeah, no, he was unbelievable to watch. As I said, behind the wheel of a car on a bit of road, hard to see anyone in the world with more raw talent. You know, a great driver, and unfortunately, lost his life in September 2007. Just we're lucky to have had so many, I suppose, guys, you know, of our heroes competing together in this season, as we can see. But yeah, that was Colin.
Another hero of ours, I think the three of us would agree unanimously, was in the third car for the bulk of the year, François Delacour. That was a brilliant year. When I look back at what I really enjoyed even back in 2001, was I'd always be waiting to see how Delacour was going. I really liked wanting to see how François Delacour was going, because just that element of lunacy that exists in somebody is always there. But Francois seems to have that 2% more of it, I think, than anyone else.
Like at events, it's almost like he's so cool, and he's just kind of like, I won't say he didn't care, but he was so kind of like, go mad on stage after that. I don't really care.
He put in a great performance all year, though. He was really consistent.
The best thing about him, you know, you're definitely going to get a good onboard from the camera facing back to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the sleeves rolled up and him pulling the gear knob after thing. But
he'd go down for me as probably, if you had say a top 10 drivers of the year, which we're not going to do because we haven't thought that far ahead, but he would probably be somewhere around the middle. You'd nearly throw him in at number 5 because he was a consistent, he was every bit as consistent as Sainz at times.
He was, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Didn't quite have the rally winning pace that he would have had, but again, he kind of just only jumped into the Ford for that single year after coming out of Peugeot.
Because he had the rally winning pace at Peugeot, he definitely had it there.
He did.
Was his car at the latest spec for that?
Yeah, it just being Dedeker being Dedeker, he just had to leave Peugeot in a hurry after all the arguments. But it's funny to know what McRae actually. McRae had nicknames for Dedeker and Panizzi. It was Psycho and Trainee Psycho. So pretty apt. But Dedeker went on to Mitsubishi for 2002, and that was his final year. Ended his kind of frontline WRC career with a pretty memorable moment where he had a standing co-driver for the event after he had another huge accident in Australia in 2002, which put Daniel Gretel up out of action for a while. So if anyone knows French, you'll remember the defois trotard shouting that was going on 10 times too late. And then I think there was sans foi.
He had him back because Francois did Monty in 2015 or 14 in the folk, it's not folks, in the Fiesta.
Did, yeah.
World Rally Car. And Francois was sitting top 2-3 times still, you know, a man of in his early 50s. He's a guy who, a bit like McRae and a bit like any of these guys, they have it. They just have it.
He's just a phenomenal natural talent. Someone said he still thinks that he'd be able to compete at the front line. You wouldn't doubt him, like. He's just that good. Yeah.
Very angry man.
Yeah. Ford themselves in as a team. If you look at it, they're the only team that is still competing this year, Joe, as in from a continuous run from 2001 on. Now, there's a lot of, you can debate whether that's an official manufacturer entry or an in-sport thing or whatever. I suppose you could theoretically say that, you know, Ford themselves went in at the end of 2012. But I suppose, you know, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt here and say there's still a Ford presence in the championship.
As a testament to Malcolm Wilson, to be able to go through so many downturns and so many things got wrong in the sport, and be able to basically keep Ford involved, I think it's a massive credit to that team in general.
It is,
and how much he's done for so many young drivers throughout the era as well as keeping the team afloat.
Yeah, there's been some fantastic moments over the years. They got Sal Petter back into the team for 2012 after he had a couple of years as a privateer during the really, really kind of barren days there, the end of the 2000s. But it was fantastic to see, you know, Malcolm Wilson get Sebastian Ogier into the team for 2017, 2018. Joe, you remember the video that went around from the announcement in Cumbria whenever he announced it to the staff, and they actually ended up winning the title both years, which is fantastic. Joe, it's really, really nice to see, because you know, they'd been so close for so long, and to see him finally do it was actually great, and especially in 2017 where, you know, you had the new rules and the competition was massive and stuff, so that was really, really cool to see.
But M-Sport, to be fair, have always been a team that when new rules come along, they seem to be the best ones out of the box straight away. Other teams will catch up and will probably get past them, but in terms of who's got the best product straight out of the box, it will be M-Sport, because generally because they operate as a business, they have to look at it on a broader scale, as they may have to sell this product to a customer at some stage as well. Yeah, they're the last of kind of, to be fair, Rally, I suppose it'll take us on to one of our next teams there, Rally Act, you know, at Andrew Cowan's. They're kind of an evolution of what the likes of Andrew Cowan and David Richards had ran. So, you know, it's still great to see them there, you know.
Yeah, definitely. That brings us nicely on to Mitsubishi, as you said, Tommy, with Rally Act. This was you know, the writing was on the wall for Mitsubishi at the end of this year already. As you know, their participation was even in doubt, I think. They limped down through 2002 and pulled out for a year and came back in 2004-2005 with the kind of crazy looking Lancer. Did pretty well, you know, all things considered. But it was actually a really, really quick fall from grace for the team, you know, from winning all around them in the late 90s to where they ended up at the end of this year was pretty big fall. Just kind of sad to see. But look, that's no discredit to anyone involved. I mean, they did the best of what they had. And, you know, we've heard it in other podcasts, especially like the Dartfish and Absolute Rally and stuff. You know, the resources weren't there compared to some of the other teams. So, yeah. No, they used what they had to the best they could. Obviously, yeah. The Marlborough, again, this we mentioned this as well, I think, at the start of the series, that, you know, they did have, there was a lot more money coming at the time from external sponsors. You know, it didn't seem to it's not as prevalent these days. I know Toyota have a couple of names on the car and, you know, bits and pieces, but at the time, you know, Marlborough obviously were involved. You know, you had, you know, big sponsorship at Ford as well and things like that. So then I don't think the budget of Mitsubishi would have been as big as it was even at the likes of Citroën. You know, Citroën obviously had PSA were throwing a lot of money at rallying at the time, so just interesting to note what way it worked out. But Tommy, you know, was in contention for the title till the final round this year. Didn't work out for him, as we went through in the GB episode. Switched to Subaru for 2002-2003. Showed flashes here and there. 2002, won the Monte by kind of default. He didn't actually win it on the road, but though I've got a time penalty for an illegal tyre change, and Macken is the name that's on the record books. Should have won Argentina, went off in an absolutely humongous way in a car, and didn't really do a huge amount after that. Flashes here and there, but got a podium in his final round. But another, you know, it was pretty sharp decline for Tommy compared to what he was used to. But to be fair to him, Peter Solberg has often given testament as to how much of a help he was for Peter in his career. You know, he was a huge influence on Peter's style and you know, kind of a guiding force for him to win the title, big support for him. So, and Tommy's obviously went on to form Time Macken Racing and is now the boss of the Toyota Gazoo Racing World Championship effort. So doing pretty well in fairness to him. So the skills needed to win four championships as a driver have obviously transferred to being a team owner, so fair play to them. So we have Freddie. Freddie ended up still getting drives for years after. Went to Hyundai for 2002 and 2003. Ended up at Peugeot after that. Went on to win Ypres about 2,000 times. In fairness to him.
So. Four of the events actually
ran. Yeah, there's a statistical anomaly there, but he's somehow...
I think, to be fair, like, Freddie can be often pointed as a bit of a figure of fun, but Freddie was a very, very fast driver. I know some people might think, yeah, he was there because of the Marlboro money. That certainly helped open the doors, but he did have the talent. I just don't think the Mitsubishi was the car for him. But he showed great speed at times in the Hyundai, which was an under-budget car and an underpowered car. Like, you heard Neil Reardon talking about it with us. Fantastic car to handle. You know, like, he could deliver. And he proved it when he went to the IRC because, you know, I think when he was in that René Georges Fabia S2000, he led Monty at once for a couple of the days. Do you remember one year they brought Monty back to be almost like a 5-day rally in the IRC?
Yeah.
And he was right at the front of it, ahead of Juho Hannan and all of them. Freddie was right in it. Like.
Yeah.
I think it might have been, yeah. Well, it could have been. I think it was 2009.
But... who else do we have with Thomas Radstrom? I went down to drive for a few events for Citroën in 2002. Didn't do much else after that. And Tony Gardemeister moved to Skoda for 2002 and 2003. And did he do... I think he did 0-4 with them as well. Ended up inside in Ford for 0-5 somehow. No one really knows what happened there, but he was there anyway. And 2006...
He supplied office chairs for them, though, to be fair. Like,
He did. There's a fantastic shot of him promoting some Finnish brand of office chairs there with the full gear on. So, okay, to him. And 2007, he ended up and was it 0708? Ended up driving for Suzuki when they were kind of ill-fated works.
That's the year he won his world title
with
Suzuki, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. We talk about alternate histories here now, are we?
Yeah.
Your jacket's worth a lot of money now, Will.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sell my jacket.
He's trying to big it up. Yeah. Catch some preamble there that doesn't know his facts.
Signed by Tony Garden myself, he stepped up the podium winning his world driver's title and manufacturer title for the second.
That's and we'll go on to Skoda.
Mars, just on the on Tony Gardner, he's now running his own TG Worldwide.
Yeah, you still see him at the WRC events running. He was running Fabias and things because I remember one of the lads got a selfie with him there one night.
I know he does a lot of work with some driver development and coaching and stuff, but he does have the similar to Marco Martin when he's set up on his own, like a lot of guys do.
Pretty good. Pretty good. So there's some Tony Gardemeister facts. Pretty well.
I don't know what his Twitter handle is, but he's a good man for...
Good man for the old cracking
Twitter. Keep tuned for Series 2 and we'll have even more.
Even more Tony Gardemeister facts coming up in Series 2. So Skoda, that kind of brings us into Skoda there with Armin Schwartz. Went moved to Hyundai for 2002-2003. Ended up back at Skoda in 2004 and 2005. Apparently had quite a big influence on the team's development and kind of ended up running a Red Bull Skoda sort of a thing for 2006 that ultimately went nowhere. That was Armin, good old man for the side of his crack, in fairness to him. Bruno Thierry finished his frontline WRC career at the end of this year and ended up driving a privateer 206 in the European Championship for a couple of years and doing...
Was that the Bastos colored one?
I think it was Bastos, yeah. It was the gorgeous little car. Bruno, I think he was going pretty well there in Germany in 0-2 and stuff. He was a quick driver, just very, very unlucky. Never really got the brakes. Scored themselves, as we said, pulled out at the end of 0-5. Went on to become arguably the best S2000 and R5 manufacturer. After that, so some very, very talented brains in Skoda Motorsport, but the World Rally Car project just never bore any fruit from there. The podium and Safari in 2001, but that was
Chris Meek is testing for them this week.
Is he? Didn't know that.
Yeah,
pretty good.
No, that's not a leak. That's a photo that's out there.
You're not just making up shit.
I'm not just making it up.
Man, okay, cool.
Suzuki World Rally Cars.
Are you just look? Stop building the hype for that fucking jacket. There's no one going to buy it. I think I threw mine in the fucking bin there a while back because I just knew it to be there's only misery. So
keep in case I'm at home and I need to walk on a dark road on a cold night, so I'm warm and
It means you're safe. No one will come near you.
Yeah, no one will definitely want to engage in conversation with a man wearing a bright yellow Suzuki jacket.
The craziest person on the road.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's a Suzuki fan.
Yeah. Finally then, Citroën, even though they only had a power program, was still covering. So we had Philippe Pogalski did a couple of more rallies from 2002 and went on to do a lot of development work for him in the subsequent years and even into the C4 days. And they had quite a big hand in the early career of Thierry Neuville, by all accounts. Philippe, unfortunately, passed away there a few years ago. He had an accident at home, fell off a ladder. So it's kind of sad to note actually how many guys that were involved at the front have passed away since. So quite tragic.
Sobering enough thought, really.
It is, That's I suppose that's life. But it's just strange to look back on it. But Jesus Porras did very few world events the following year. I think it was kind of a not even the full Citroën Sport entry. It was kind of a Citroën Sport Spain sort of a thing.
Pierre Fisa, was that the name of the team? It was something possibly, kind of...
I think you could be right. I think he won the Spanish Championship either in 0-1 or 0-2 in his era. But after that, kind of not much else was heard from. And then that other fellow Loeb, I don't know what happened. Anyway, I actually couldn't even find any information on what happened to Sebastian Loeb. He might be able to fill in the gaps.
His parents are away this weekend and they've got satellite.
Oh, yeah, we'll call him over, yeah. He's tremendous fun. No, all jokes aside, Loeb went on to be you know, the most successful driver in sports history by far. As I'm sure you're all aware, if you're a rally fan of any sort, you'll have heard of Sebastian Loeb. Absolute legend. One of the best drivers in the history of motorsport, full stop. And just interesting to see 2001, you know, this is the kind of the real start of it all for him as a, you know, one of the greats. So pretty cool to look back in it and see where it all kicked off. Citroën themselves then, you know, went on to dominate for the rest of the 2000s. From 2004 onwards, they were untouchable. Kind of mixed bag there in the 2010s. Didn't really get things going. It was kind of, the team was pretty much a shadow of its former self, and they actually ended up withdrawing at the end of last year. So, you know,
bizarre financial irregularities.
Yeah. They had a nasty habit of blaming crews for underlying issues with the cars. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We won't get too deep into it now.
But when you look at the driver lineup, and like we talk about how it's influenced us and how, you know, it's great looking back, and even now they're still our heroes. And even, you know, the PWRC guys and JWRC guys that we followed into the ERC and IRC things. But you look at the lineage that's followed on. Carlos Sainz, his son, is an F1 driver now. Arguably, he picked the wrong discipline. But you've Petter Solberg's son, who only won a rally there at the weekend. And
isn't it correct? I reckon Carlos Sainz Jr. will be multiple F1 world champion this time if you just let him use fucking pace nuts. That's the killer. They just won't let him use the nuts. Yeah.
Line.
Yeah. Line. Just one line.
Everywhere. Line.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So, and obviously, Kelly Rovanpera as well, Harry's son. And I believe Marcus Granholm's son is going pretty well in rallycross as well. So, yeah, we just want to move on and just give a shout out there to all the people that have come on over the course of the first series and helped us out and things like that. So, like, you know, looking at the list of guests we've had on here, we've had Dale Wearden, Trevor Agnew, John McElroy, Jeremy Hart, Mark James, John Desborough, Colin McMaster, Niall McShea, and Robert Reed. I mean, that list, you know, it's pretty class to look at.
It's a cool entry list.
It's a good intro list, yeah. In fairness, no.
All the big names.
But like, just allow us a small bit of a fanboy moment. You know, that's class. These people are our heroes. You know, they're the voices and the crews from the time that were, you know, our most precious or our most treasured memories of the sport involved these people. Like, so to get them on was huge, and we just can't thank them enough. Really, for coming on and giving us those stories, and we'll be sure to get both a few of those guys on again in the future, and as well as some more special guests. So thanks to all of you guys for coming on. It's been absolutely fantastic, and I know that anyone listening really enjoyed them as well. So
I think what's wonderful to hear as well, when, you know, you're talking to these people, they've been so giving of their time with you, is that the parallels between them and yourself, you're hearing their stories back and forth back to you, and you're like, you can relate to it so much, and you realize that we're all just cut from the same cloth. You know, like I did have to laugh when Niall McShea started talking about Days of Thunder being his favorite film. I had to mute the microphone because this is ridiculous. But yeah. But like, it's been so good that they were so giving of their time and so open with us, you know, because we're living, as you joked earlier, you know, very cynical, you know. We're living in a very cynical world. It's great to have guys that are keen to talk so passionately about the sport they love. And it's great to see other podcasts emerging as well, too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. We have to give that group, we have to give Trevor Agnew a very big thanks to him, because Trevor got in touch with us there after a couple of episodes and just to express how much he was enjoying them. And just between chatting back and forth, we ended up getting him and Neil Wearden on to chat with us. And, you know, from there, Trevor put us in touch with a couple of more people. And, you know, he's actually been great encouragement and given us some great advice throughout the series. So we're very, very grateful for that. Trevor's obviously doing his own podcast, the Stage by Stage podcast. If you haven't already listened, do go check that out. But no, fair play to him. He's been a great help. So we owe him a pint or 10, definitely, whenever we all get to meet up again. But anyway, we also have to give a huge thanks to Art McCarrick for coming on for a few episodes as well. Art is a great guy, a fountain of knowledge, as well. Just he's the cut from the same cloth as us as well. Just a pure fanatic for this year of the sport. So it's great to get him on for a few episodes. We'll have him on again in the future. He's great crack. So, and same with Jamie Arkell as well. Jamie Arkell from the Gravel Crew joined us for the Rally GB episode. Jamie's a top bloke, fountain of knowledge like Art as well. Proper rally nerd to a serious degree, and we'll be sure to get Jamie on again in the near future. Just I suppose a few bits we want to kind of reflect on ourselves, and hopefully we can rectify for series two. I suppose when we started the podcast, we kind of just, I actually was looking back through all texts today, and it was kind of towards the end of March this year that we said, yeah, let's go for it. We've kind of been talking about it, you know, in passing for probably a year or two before this, but never actually done anything about it. I just got into my head one evening that it was in a one season would be the one to go for. We were all like lucky enough, we were still able to work from home or whatever, but I had a bit more, I suppose, free time. Couldn't really leave the house that much. So we said, yeah, now is the time to do it. And we, you know, we thought it'd be good to give people something to listen to for that period as well. But because of that sort of impulsive sort of decision to go ahead and do it, our audio quality, as you probably will have heard, throughout all the episodes could definitely be improved on. So that's something we'll try and work on for series two. Again, you know, we're all working full-time jobs. This is just a pastime for us. So, you know, we'll try to squeeze it in when we can. And the editing does take a bit of time. So look, again, this is something that we'll try and improve for series two, because I know myself, anything I listen to, I like the audio quality to be as good as possible. So apologies for anyone we may have annoyed with various issues and on that side, but we'll try and do our best to get it going. Obviously, we're up on, I think, nearly every platform at this stage that you can find us on. We're not on YouTube, but I don't know if anyone listens to podcasts on YouTube. Maybe we'll bring the element in the future if we ever actually do some video stuff, but yeah, that's not a big priority at the moment.
Bear in mind, if we do improve the audio quality, there's nothing we can't promise anything about accents, speed of talking, colloquialisms.
Yeah. Bannerhead references. Lies, slander. Yeah, no, that's not going to change. It's just the actual fidelity of the stuff, of the shit that's coming out of our mouths, basically.
But so anyway, we apologise. The product is going to stay the same. We might try and improve
The product will probably get worse, actually.
Can it
get any worse? I don't know. We're pretty bad. But anyway, look.
You're like watching 90s movies in HD on new TVs where you can spot all of the imperfections.
All the issues. Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah, so anyway, maybe some people might enjoy the charm, maybe to throw back to, you know, the audio quality that was around at the time, but I don't think so. Look, it's just, it's our fault. Look, we're holding our hands up here. It's our fault. We'll try and get it started.
Our first communication about doing this was back in January 2018.
Was it? Whoa. Yeah. That's more than 2 years ago. That's two fucking half years ago. Whoa. At least no one can accuse us of rushing into something. Anyway, can they?
We give ourselves a good run up at it.
It was 2 years to start a podcast on a 20-year-old season.
Yeah. But anyway, as I said, look, we'd only been kind of mentioned in passing. We didn't actually go and do anything about it, because I suppose we thought we'd have to, you know, meet up to do it, and you know, we're all living quite far away from each other, and I suppose the fact that we have to do everything by Zoom now, probably, you know, gave us the impetus to just drive on, made it a lot easier then as well to interview people involved, because, you know, it's trying to arrange people to be in the same place at the same time, especially when there's no events on, is very tricky. But yeah, I suppose we did what we could and what we have. So as I said, we'll try and improve on it for series two as well. We're going to switch to a bi-weekly format for the majority of the episodes, because as I said, look, we're all working full time, and we really don't want the quality of the content to suffer. And I just feel that with, you know, other things going on in our lives at the moment, that it'll just be a little bit, you know, tricky to get a good, decent episode out every week. We'd rather release every 2 weeks and keep the same kind of length and I suppose quality, if you want to call it that, of content. Quality content now is probably a bit of a different tone from what we were doing, but sure, look. Anyway, that's going to be the situation from then on. But look, anyway, we'll keep you posted as to what's happening with that. Just a quick little preview for Series 2, for some of the topics we're going to be covering. We're going to take a look at the Celtic Tiger era and Irish rallying, especially around the WRC cars and all the mad stuff that was happening back then, like the rally forums and the RPM coverage, all that sort of stuff. So be sure and check us out for that. 2003 season, we'll do a couple of episodes of that. We'll hopefully have a couple of special guests related to that time coming on as well. So we'll keep you posted on those. We'll cover some stuff on the heyday of the European Championship. Back up was really, really cool and full of cigarette sponsors and all that kind of good stuff. We'll do something on Rally Legend and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think we'll probably have about 10 episodes. We haven't everything kind of nailed down just yet. We've a couple of bits started, but when we get that, we'll let you know. We'll probably be taking a small bit of a break, maybe for a couple of weeks after this episode as well. But just keep an eye on the social media channels and things like that. We'll let you know when the next episode is due. So,
you have been warned. We will return. We're like James Bond.
We're like a bad penny. We just turn up.
Love that at the end of every James Bond film. James Bond will return.
Yes.
Sprint podcast will return.
Anyway, probably got rid of those bastards. But anyway, look, I just want to just round out this series by saying, look, thanks again to everyone for tuning in. Thanks to everyone who came on as guests and, you know, gave us encouragement and help along the way. It's been a brilliant experience. I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't think we'd ever get to, you know, this sort of a level with it. To be able to speak to the heroes from the time, and, you know, to get the listener figures that we have. You know, we topped a few podcast charts and stuff like that, which is just, you know, it's crazy.
It's surreal.
It's humbling. Yeah, it's really, really cool. And look, it just hopefully we've given you as a listener, you know, some good enjoyment from the time. And look, we'll endeavor to keep it up as much as possible over the next few seasons. So yeah, that's kind of it for me. Anything, guys, you want to add?
I just think it's been brilliant to get the support we have. And if anyone had any doubt how much you loved motorsport, we'd like to hope that it's reignited any kind of fire that's still within you for rallying motorsport, because it's just really hit home as to how good the sport can be and how great the things that inspire you to go and compete or even go march to spectate. It's just been fantastic, and thanks very much to everyone for tuning in and supporting us.
Yeah, I suppose I'd just say the same. It's nice to have people I suppose our age and generation who lived through that era of the sport around the same age. I'd like to think that maybe if there's younger people listening to this, that they can see how caught our imagination at that age. And never know, we might have some contribution to someone getting addicted to the world's most expensive drug.
Yeah. Don't blame us, actually, if you're financially crippled from your involvement in the sport.
Run quite fast.
Yeah.
Come to think of it, like, actually, this year has a lot to be blamed for. I blame this year for picking the course I did in college, because that was due. That was picked with purely the motive of, yeah, if I get a job off the back of this, that'll fund rallying, that'll fund a career in this, you know, and it didn't, but I still didn't give up and still tore at it anyway. Same with you, Will. Yeah, damn 2001 anyway. We're broke because of it.
Yeah, I became an engineer because I wanted to be, you know, involved in this sort of stuff as a career. You know, it's pivotal. This, yeah, again, it just shows how you know, important this kind of stuff is when you're at that easily influenced age, that, you know, how things like this can have such an impact and such a bearing on your life. And I wouldn't change it for the world. We've made so many friends from the sport and just cars in general. Like I just can't. There's nothing else I'd want to be into. I can't imagine life without it. You know, it's been fantastic. So
it's been fantastic as well to have had people who've actually, like, I think, look, I know at the risk of repeating ourselves, but we've had people who genuinely did inspire us as kids and teenagers, the likes of Robert, the likes of Niall, the likes of the guys like John Desborough and Mark and Jeremy, you know, those guys, you know, they're the ones that have led to me sitting in a rally car calling notes, led to you, Will, going rallying, you yourself doing a bit of rallying and writing about it. You know, it's been brilliant to meet these guys and even virtually and have them on. Wouldn't regret a minute of this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But yeah, so that finishes series one of the Sprint Podcast. Thank you all for tuning in. And we shall speak to you soon. Until then, from Tommy, William, and myself, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.